please turn to Deuteronomy 6, verse 10. And when the Lord your God brings you into the land that he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, to give you, with great and good cities that you did not build, and houses full of all good things that you did not fill, and cisterns that you didn't dig, and vineyards and olive trees that you did not plant. And when you eat and are full, then take care lest you forget the Lord, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. It is the Lord your God you shall fear. Him you shall serve, and by his name you shall swear. You shall not go after other gods, the gods of the peoples who are around you. For the Lord your God in your midst is a jealous God, lest the anger of the Lord your God be kindled against you, and he destroy you from off the face of the earth. You shall not put the Lord your God to the test, as you tested him at Massah. You shall diligently keep the commandments of the Lord your God, and his testimonies and his statutes which he has commanded you. And you shall do what is right and good in the sight of the Lord, that it may go well with you, and that you may go in and take possession of the land that the Lord swore to give to your fathers, by thrusting out all your enemies from before you, as the Lord has promised. And when your son asks you in time to come, what is the meaning of the testimonies and the statutes and the rules that the Lord our God has commanded you? Then you shall say to your son, we were Pharaoh's slaves in Egypt, and the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand. And the Lord showed signs and wonders, great and grievous, against Egypt and against Pharaoh and all his household before our eyes. And he brought us out from there that he might bring us in and give us the land that he swore to give our fathers. And the Lord commanded us to do all these statutes, to fear the Lord our God for our good always, that he might preserve us alive as we are this day. And it will be righteousness for us if we are careful to do all this commandment before the Lord our God as he has commanded us. Jehoahaz was the son of King Josiah, who fell in battle in the year 609 BC. 2 Kings chapter 23 tells us that Jehoahaz was a lad of only 23 years when he became king, and he reigned for only 3 months. What did he think? What did he dream of? What were his ambitions when he came to the throne of his father? As you perhaps remember, Josiah, his father, had forced tough reforms on Judah in order to reestablish genuine, authentic worship in Judah. And his son, Jehoahaz, grew up under his tutelage, and he had seen all of these painstaking efforts to bring the people back to the fear of the Lord. And now he faced the question of whether he would listen to these voices from the past, of whether he would continue in his father's footsteps. Every young person has to answer the same question, namely how to shape one's life and what to learn from past voices, what to learn from your parents. The historian of 2 Kings summarizes Jehoahaz's response or decision in the most laconic remark, which also becomes one of the refrains of the book of Kings. He did evil in the eyes of Yahweh. 3 months are enough to destroy the work of a father and to cause Judah to return to the idols they used to serve. But after this, others decide over Jehoahaz's course of life, and he is given no chance to show that he could possibly change for the better. But the king of Egypt takes him and condemns the young man to life in bonds at the fortress of Rivlah. And that's the last that you hear of this young man. Chances are he never got out of there. Chances are he died in chains. Makes no difference whether one ignores God's word for 3 months or for 30 years. Whoever doesn't hear the word that is meant to be heard and wants to be heard, whoever doesn't hear the word will also be judged by it. Now, last week, we learned from the famous Shema that a posture of listening is the basis of any obedient response for Israel and also for us Christians. A posture of listening. The spirit of the law, as we learned from the Shema, is to love God with abandon, without holding back, with your whole heart, soul, and all your might. Israel would always be on the verge of new possibilities if they continued to walk in love, in this kind of love. They would always be on the verge of new possibilities. They would always have hope. There would always be a way forward. This is because God made it so. This is because of God's promise. Enjoyment of the land depended on their continuing posture as hearers and doers of the word, which is the test of love. Will you do my word? The future will be shaped by the decision to either hear or not to hear. But you already know this, don't you? Now, the second half of chapter 6 is an exposé of these three salient declarations of the Shema, and I will repeat them now. I will rehearse them to refresh our memory. The declarative force of the Shema rests on three assertions about God. It's like a creed, a very basic, very simple creed, but very effective and very inclusive. The first declaration of the Shema was, Yahweh is our God, Yahweh is one. The second one was based on the very same word in Hebrew, but an alternative, equally valid translation, namely, Yahweh is our God, Yahweh alone. And then finally, the third assertion was, Yahweh is our God, with the emphasis on our. The first one, Yahweh our God is one, means that he is singular. He is unlike any other being. He is not divided in any sense of the word. He's never deterred in his purpose. He never sways from his will. He is one. And this also means God being singular and not divided, he always acts consistent with his holy character. My children, or we go through a basic children's catechism with our children. One of the questions is this, if you remember Ella and Quinn. Can God do all things? And the answer to it is, yes, God can do all his holy will. God is not a despot. He's not unpredictable. Today here, tomorrow there. He is always predictable because he acts consistent with his holy character. He will never violate who he is. And so, God is one means that he is a God who demands, who commands our trust. Put quite simply, There's not another person in the universe or in all creation that commands trust. The mightiest of the angels, the holiest of the angels, do not command our trust. Only the Lord, because only He is one. Now, the second declaration of the Shema was based on the same Hebrew phrase, and it is, Yahweh is God alone. Not one, but alone. And this rendering turns the spotlight on Israel's loyalty to this God. They were to worship and serve Yahweh alone, as opposed to the many options that they had in Canaan to worship the ancient Near Eastern pantheon, the many gods that were being worshipped in that culture. And finally, the affirmation also contained in the Shema that Yahweh is our God implies election, implies redemption, even implies the gift of a land. When I say God is my God, I am always implying a history between me and my God. Why is He my God? Because God elected me, because God saved me, because God has given me promises. He is my God. And in the same way, our God in the Shema means God has elected Israel. He's chosen Israel among all the nations. He's brought them out of Egypt. That's why He is our God. And He is bringing us into the land. That's why He is our God. So our God activates the entire history of God and His people. And this threefold creed is now thrown into relief by showing how each of these affirmations, each one of the three, will be tested in Canaan. The first test is highlighted in 6:10 through 15. You quickly take a look at this with me. 6:10 through 11 describes the land's many blessings. It's a rich land, it's a blessed land, because God will take care of it and He will make it fruitful. And none of these blessings, none of them were the product of Israel's work. The land and its richness is a gift of grace, pure grace, for Israel to enjoy and then in return to bless God for it, to worship Him for it. But as Proverbs 27:7 says, the full soul loathes a honeycomb. Material blessings can lead to complacency. They carry their own temptations. They tend to make us forget that we depend upon God for everything, and we become complacent. Translated into our culture, we could say, money is in the bank, food is in the refrigerator, and as we are used to saying, there's plenty more where that came from. Just go to the grocery store, get it. But 6:10 through 15 doesn't stop here. What happens when we forget God? What happens when God fades from our lives or drifts to the periphery of our existence? An empty house will not remain empty. The vacuum will be filled. Humans have been made to worship God, as we have said in recent weeks and more than once. The church exists to worship God. And whether we concede this or not, we will worship. So Moses warns the people that if you forget Yahweh, to whom you owe everything, the vacant spot in your heart will be filled by other gods. It's inevitable. Inevitable. In the case of Israel, of course, these were the Canaanite fertility gods and their consorts. These gods weren't nearly as demanding as Yahweh who took everything from Israel, demanding total loyalty of the entire person, heart, soul, and might. Now, but these gods, they could be manipulated by adhering to seasonal rituals. Every once in a while, a seasonal ritual in order to reap the blessings. What are the God replacements in your life? What are the idols that compete with your God? Your career? And do you perhaps think that if you pay homage to the God of career, that then God will bless you and all your dreams will come true somehow? Is it your education? Is it your righteousness? Your money, your youth, your family, or simply the big fat you? It's clear that this first test in the land that Moses describes here concerns the declaration contained in the Shema that, "Hear Israel, Yahweh is our God, Yahweh alone." This test in 10 through 15 concerns this declaration, Yahweh alone. No other gods, but Yahweh alone. Israel faced the test of giving their love to others. And God, as we have just read, is a jealous God. He cannot stand it. His heart is torn when his people give their love to others. And this is the test. Give your love to other gods and not to Yahweh alone. This decision is before Israel. This decision is before you. It will be before you today, for the rest of this day, and tomorrow, and every day. 6:16 through 19 shifts gears and highlights another test arising from the Shema. You shan't put to the test Yahweh your God as you tested him at Massah. The place now Massah is like a hook. Once you hear it, it demands attention. So what happened there at Massah? Exodus 17 records how Israel, after having crossed the Red Sea, found herself in the wilderness of Sin. And there was no water for the people to drink. The people therefore quarreled with Moses, saying, "Give us water to drink." And Moses said, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord?" Moses' interpretation of the people's agenda is correct. In their grumbling against Moses, they entertained grumbling against God. They tested the Lord, and the nature of that test is then summarized by the narrator in 17:7, who brings everything to a point, to a focal point. And he renders what was in the hearts of the people who quarreled in the following way. They were asking the question, "Is Yahweh among us or not? We want to know. Is Yahweh among us or not?" And this question is not about the existence of God. Does God exist? And this question is not about whether God is in that place in the wilderness of Sin. Is God here? This question concerns God's disposition. Did God bring the people out of Egypt to let them die of thirst? And if so, what does this say about his nature and his disposition toward Israel? What does this say about his character? A God who does this sort of thing is a God who doesn't act consistently with his character and who can't be trusted. What the people really were asking when they said, "Is the Lord among us?" is God with us? Or rather, is God for us? Or is he against us? We do believe he exists. We do believe that he is everywhere, but is he for us? Is he really for us? And in recalling the Massah incident, Moses raises the challenge that arises from the Shema's claim, Yahweh is one. The singularity of God, as we said, means that he acts consistently, namely in accord with his holy character. And if God redeems Israel from slavery out of the house of Egypt, it's not to kill his people. A demon would do this, not the holy God of heaven. And if he demonstrated his love in the past, how can he now be a different kind of God? God is one, and he commands absolute trust in his goodness. And as you can see here from 6:19, take a look at this. Israel would be tempted to doubt God's goodness in the war of Canaan. This is a different situation than the complacency in the first five verses, where the people live in a time of plenty, in a time of blessing. This is a war. And they would be tempted specifically to doubt God's goodness. War means danger, means loss. And can God be trusted to make good on his word? Here then is the temptation to withhold your love from God in difficulty. You can give your love to other gods. That's usually happening when you are living in complacent times. In difficult times, you are more likely to withhold your love from God. Life is full of difficulties. Even dangers and death are looming in the wings. And the question is the Lord among us? You see, it rolls too easily from our lips. Can we trust the Lord? Does he know? Does he really know where we are in life? Can he see us? And can we trust him with our whole existence? Peter says, and this is remarkable, he says that you should never be surprised when your faith is tempted in difficult times, even the most difficult of times. Don't be surprised, Peter says. In fact, if anything, you should reckon that this will happen. Don't be surprised. You have been grieved by various trials so that the tested genuineness of your faith may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. The trials and the difficulties exist for this very purpose. They've been raised by God. And your faith in God's unchanging character, God is one, it will be tested as to its genuineness. Don't be surprised. All the more, you must look to Christ as the compass of your life's journey. And looking to the crucified Savior, you are reminded of God's true character. If you want to know God's true character, look to the cross. He makes all things, even the ugly cross, especially the ugly cross, work together for good for those who love him. But love him you must in order to experience these good things. Trust him always. So, test one is to give your love to others in time of plenty. Test number two is to withhold your love in time of difficulty. Test number three now follows on the heels, 6:20 through 25. And this short paragraph counters the temptation of doing even right things, externally right things, for the wrong reasons. Namely, to go through the motions. And of all these temptations, this is quite possibly the most potent one. An outward conformity to the standards of the law. God knows even ancient Israel was capable of this. Paul knows of this. He says they have a show of godliness, but they deny the power of it. But there is some conformity. And there are many Christians in today's churches that do show outward signs of salvation, outward signs of knowing God. But there is more than meets the eye. And in this case, we see here in this short passage, tradition is good and necessary. A people without a history are a people without a future, because they are a people without roots, without identity, and they don't know where to go. Tradition is good and necessary because without it, we have nowhere to go. But tradition can be manicured like a graveyard. And it is not the living but the dead who are at home on the graveyard. The temptation we face, according to this third test, is to simply forget why we do what we do, why we exist and do what we do. Why do we serve God? Why do we love God? Because He first loved us. He glorified Himself in loving us. We exist for His glory, and we glorify Him by loving Him back. As the Shema would say, we love God because the Lord is our God. 6:20 through 25 consists of a child's question and the adult's response. So, when faced with a challenge of competing cultures, and Israel faced them as we do, children will ask for a reason for their way of life. They want to know, and they have every right to ask the question. God acknowledges it here when He anticipates it. This will happen, and I'm not saying it's wrong. They must ask this question, and they must hear the right answer. And whether the question arises out of ignorance or curiosity or cynicism, it makes no difference. The child is in effect asking, why are we governed by this set of laws? And sometimes the child will already have the answer. I was traveling in the car a few days ago, and I heard one of my children singing a little jingle, a song, and I was baffled when I heard it, first of all, because I didn't know that they already know how to produce rhyme. But then I heard what they were singing, and this is what they sang. 1, 2, 3, A, B, C, you don't know what's good for me, and so forth. It's not a good experience for a father, because you don't know what to do with this. It's cute, yes, but it's also very indicative that the child is already asking these questions and appears to have found an answer. The answer of the parent here assumes the form of a simple family catechism. Israel were slaves in Egypt. Yahweh saved them by His power. Yahweh brought them into the land He had promised. In His grace, God saved us and revealed to us the appropriate response to this His love, that we might love Him. That's all. It's a simple family catechism. Now, the Reformers identified three uses of the law. The first one was evangelistic, namely, the law exists to exhibit God's standard of righteousness and to convict sinners, to bring them under conviction. So this is a use of the law intended for unbelievers, people who live in this world like us. Second, the law was given to guide civil authorities in administering proper justice. And as a guide for administering justice, the second use of the law is the so-called civic use of the law. And the third use, according to the Reformers, is to guide believers. This is for believers. Guide believers to a proper response to God's grace. Now, Martin Luther paid little attention to the third use of the law, but I would maintain that this remains the most important one for you as a Christian. The law as a guide to a proper response to God's grace. What shape does my response take? What help can I claim? I need guidance. The law is a guide in this sense. How do we respond to questions of the kind that are raised here by our children, or by way of extension, by the people out there? How do we answer? I am sure that Jehoahaz, the son of Josiah, raised these questions, and he also gave his own answer to these questions before he led Israel to their ruin. But do we take these kinds of questions? Do we understand that they are glorious opportunities to declare the good news, to share the gospel? And perhaps when such questions arise, we might reply with a contextualized version of this catechism in 620 through 25. And this is how it would sound or read. When our children ask us in days to come, what is the meaning of the laws we observe? Then we will say we were slaves to sin and death. But the Lord rescued us from the domain of darkness and ushered us into his glorious kingdom of light with a strong hand and great signs and great wonders. He has brought us out in fulfillment of his promises and in accord with his glorious plan of salvation that he conceived before the foundation of the world. So the Lord commanded us to demonstrate our love for him by keeping his commandments for our good always, as it is this day. And it will be righteousness for us before him if we are careful to show that we love him with all our hearts by doing what he commands. Then, too, we will hear him say, "Well done, good and faithful servant. Enter into the joy of your Lord." Amen.